that's my kind of introduction. Get up and talk. I'm Sarah Beth, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 29th, 1987. And my home group is As You Like It. Meets Sunday morning in Charlottesville. We're represented in the audience. Well represented. It is really nice to be here. I am so grateful to have been asked, and I'm so grateful that I have something I feel like I can say in terms of carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and sharing my experience, strength, and hope. There was a time when I was in AA where I had a lot to say, and it wasn't all that great. It was not based on any experience of the steps and not based on anything I thought of as alcoholism and just, you know, my opinion that I was happy to freely share with others. And I got the infamous AA response to much of it, which was keep coming back. So I did, and things have been a lot better since then. Between then and now, I didn't put the steps into my life and wound up drinking again, which is what happens to a lot of us. I like the references in the big book that say, if you're an alcoholic like me, or if you are like us, something like that. Because when I first came in, I didn't think I was like anybody here, really. And that's a really common experience, which is kind of funny. Because I could come into a room and people could say, well, we all thought that about ourselves. And I would think to myself, yeah, but you don't think it like I think it. And I heard at an AA convention one time, an AA speaker got up and said, if you put a flag up on top of a hill and wrote up there, I'm different, all the alcoholics would crowd around the hill and salute. And, you know, by the time I felt like I was one of us, I really identified with that and thought that was really funny. There was a time I probably would have been pretty offended. I was driving up here thinking, how am I going to start this whole shindig? Maybe I'm going to say it was a dark and stormy night, because that's what it feels like. And it was a dark and stormy night, actually. Not literally, but, you know, I felt like my drinking experience was like that in a lot of parts, and certainly in a whole bunch of ways I hadn't intended. I came up in a family where an alcoholic was like a Skid Row drunk. That's really what my concept of alcoholism was. And I always say that I grew up in Leave It to Beaverland because my parents were really kind and sweet, and I grew up in a nice neighborhood, and nobody was calling anybody any names in my house, and nobody was drinking themselves to death in my house, and it really did feel like Leave It to Beaverland. And I think you can get too much good sometimes, and that can be kind of weird too. You know, because I kind of got the message in my house that you're okay as long as you're not X, Y, and Z. And along the way, I sort of figured out I was X, and then a little later figured out I was Y, and a little later figured out I was Z. And it led to my feeling that I was different. In a lot of ways, I felt different from my family. But it wasn't like I had, you know, kind of the textbook alcoholic dysfunctional family or anything like that. And so a lot of people talk about those environments, I think, in AA, because sometimes that has a lot to do with why we picked up in the first place. I personally, except for the genetics, don't think it has a lot to do with why we're alcoholic. I mean, I'm of the mindset that I believe I'm physically and mentally or bodily and mentally different from my fellows. So I can drink at or over just about anything, just like the next guy can. But if the next guy is not alcoholic, he's not going to have happen in his life the kinds of things that happen in mine. And I don't just mean my life, like my surrounding life. I mean, for me, mostly my life inside, my life right inside my skin. Because the way I describe my alcoholism is that it deteriorated me or rotted me from the inside out. So I think around the first time I drank and got drunk, I was with a bunch of kids in my neighborhood, and everybody, it was in the 70s, so everybody took off their clothes and went streaking. And I heard people in AA say that was the first of many nights like that. But it wasn't that case. It wasn't the case for me. It was like, that was probably the only night that looked like that for me. And that's one of the reasons I came to believe that I was different. Because I had a lot of people around me who had some pretty wild stuff going on when they would get drunk. And those things were not happening to me. So I could keep those people around me making all kinds of fuss and mess and continue to tell myself, as long as I didn't do that, then I was fine. It's too bad that didn't turn out to be true, but I told it to myself for a very long time. And, you know, my early drinking was just, I think, pretty much an effort to do what the big people do. I just, you know, when I'm speaking at an AA meeting, I try to tell about the first time I drank. My parents had cocktail parties when I was little, and they broke out the booze kind of only for the company. I mean, literally, I can remember my parents dusting off the booze bottles when it was time to have a party so they would look better, because they'd been in the cabinet since whenever the last time was. And I was the only daughter of my Southern parents, and so when my family had a party, or, you know, a cocktail party or something, I had to run around and be the little hostess, and this was when I was really small. And I really liked the look of those drinks, not because I thought they were alcohol, because I don't think I really grasped what it was. But I knew it's what the big people were doing, and I knew that I was told no. And I knew that the drinks had a bunch of maraschino cherries and a bunch of olives and a bunch of plastic swords and a bunch of umbrellas, and I wanted them. And so, you know, so when I was cleaning up the mess, I ran around to pick up all the cups, and all the non-alcoholics in the crowd left booze in their cups and let the ice melt down in them and stuff, and there was kind of some alcohol water left in the drinks. And I would go around there and tip those back on my way back into the kitchen and bring my mother all the empty cups. And that's how I took my first drinks. And it wasn't like, here, let me get into trouble. It was like, here, let me do what the big people did and kind of walk around in my fantasy and world that I was all grown up and sophisticated. And it's quite, I think, quite common or quite innocent. But it was like it says, you know, we say in AA sometimes one is too many, a thousand never enough. Once I got that first one in me and got a taste for that, I'm not going to describe it much more than that, because whenever I go to a meeting and someone goes into that, I still, like, my hair stands up on the back of my neck when they talk about how that first feeling was, and I can still feel that in my body so much today, even though it's been such a long time. But that must have been what happened, and it kind of woke up that that soon-to-be active alcoholism. And what I started to do was seek out alcohol every chance I got, which wasn't much of a chance, you know, in my home and in the neighborhood I grew up in. But it was every chance I got, which later told me a lot about my alcoholism. And when I didn't get chances, I spent a lot of time trying to create those chances, and I failed miserably sometimes. But, you know, I would go out with my friends. We had a big woods behind us, and we would go out in the woods, and I would start talking about, does anybody's parents have any beer in their fridge or anything that we could steal? And some kids were like, yeah, let's do that. And some kids would be like, what is your problem? Giving me that look that, you know, complete disinterest or complete not, you know, just not wanting to be bad, or I don't know, something like that. And so right from the beginning, I was in these two kind of crowds, the well-behaved and the let's get into as much trouble as possible crowd. And I continued to run with those two crowds for the rest of my drinking life, kind of one foot in one world and one foot in the other. And as my alcoholism progressed, just feeling those two worlds pull further and further and further apart. More of a feeling like I was having a double life. But I was out in high school. I was obsessed about alcohol. One of the things I say all the time is when I was out with my friends, we would be going to the movies, and they would be focused on what movie we were going to go see. We had a big drive-in theater in my town. I guess that's almost a thing of the past. And I'd never cared what we were seeing. I never cared who was going, how many cars we were taking. I just wanted to be in the car that was going to get the alcohol. And I always wanted to be the one who counted how many people were going so that I could double the number or something like that. Well, so-and-so said they were coming, and so-and-so said they were coming, and I would kind of take into the account more people that were actually going to be there, so we would overshoot the beer or something. And then I would feel like I had enough. And I have a completely different perspective on that kind of stuff now than I did then. I say, once I got the look, you know, when I call the look from my friends, they're like, hey, there's something wrong with you, I just shut up about it all right away. I didn't keep on talking about how much I was thinking about drinking. I didn't keep on talking about how much I wanted to go get pot, because at the time, pot was way easier to get than alcohol if you're like 14 or 15, whatever age I was. And as soon as I got that look from people, I just started lying about it and started sneaking. And, you know, the way I was raised in my family, my father wasn't like, hey, conform, conform, conform. But he was very much like, don't be weird and bad, you know. And as soon as I came into something that was like weird and bad, I had to start lying about it. And that's what was starting to happen with my obsession about alcohol. So, you know, I started drinking and wanting certain kinds of feelings when I would drink. And I would have those kind of feelings for about a nanosecond. And then everything would go downhill after that. My whole emotional state, my ability to interact with my friends, you know, whatever it is I was hoping for, I would hit that thing for just a second. And that was it. And I spent all the rest of the time drinking and more in, trying to recover that, whatever that little teeny tiny window was I thought that I wanted. Some kind of comfort, some kind of high or buzz. And it wasn't that I didn't enjoy getting drunk, because I did. I just didn't enjoy it like I meant to. I meant for it to be a certain way every time. And I had a good time drinking. There was plenty of times that I enjoyed myself, which continued to feed this idea that I was fine. And that if something wasn't fine on any given night or on any given day, it must have been the variables of what was going on that day. It couldn't have had anything to do with the alcohol. For instance, in college, I ordered a big fat pizza and a big fat case of beer and drank the big fat case of beer and ate the pizza. And then when I spent the rest of the night throwing up, I called the pizza place and yelled at them. That's kind of how the brain worked. And, it never crossed my mind that I had any kind of allergy to alcohol or anything like that. So the more I drank, the more I began to feel that my attitudes about it were strange, the more I lied to myself and all the people around me. I would go to parties and try to get alcohol before the party, pour a bunch in, because I didn't want people at the party to see how much or how important to me it was, I guess, is kind of the bigger thing. I mean, it's not so much about how much, because I think there's some kind of badge of honor if you can drink your friends under the table and you can hold more alcohol than everyone else. But I really didn't want people to know how much I cared that I had a drink in my hand. And so I drank quite a bit before the parties. And then I would come in with some reasonable amount of alcohol, which was never enough for me, like a six-pack of beer, and put it in the fridge. And to me, this is like the non-alcoholic honor system. You put your beer in the fridge at the party, and you expect to go back and find it there. You don't expect those alcoholics who are sneaking around stealing all the alcohol to have taken your, drank your drinks up. And that's the kind of person that I was becoming. I was the kind of, you know, becoming the kind of person who would come into a party and open the refrigerator and start looking around to see who was looking, take what I could take, pour it into a different glass. Like, you know, if you had some kind of weird beer, I wouldn't walk out into the living room with your weird beer. I would pour it into a glass or a cup and ditch the bottle and all this kind of really wacky, twisted, covering my tracks sort of stuff. And, you know, I just went on like that. And I went on to college and got to college, and that was the first time that I was any place where I was unsupervised. You know, I didn't come home drunk to my house. I would stay out at friends if I needed to stay out. And I don't know how I managed to keep it from my family the way that I did, but I did. And I went off to college, and I started drinking. And by the time I had unsupervised alcohol consumption, I went there in August, and by October, I decided that I had a problem with alcohol and I needed to give it a big pause. And so it was just after, you know, 2 months or whatever of unsupervised drinking. And so I told myself that I needed to lay off, that I was hitting it a little too hard. Never, ever, ever crossed my mind that I was an alcoholic. I'm a morning person. I scheduled all my classes at 8 o'clock in the morning, which all my heavy partying friends were scheduling their classes at 2 or something like that. I would schedule mine at 8 because I'm a morning person. And instead, what would happen was I would stay out all entire night drinking, show up at my class intoxicated, sit through my class, and then come home and go to bed, if I even made it at all. And so, you know, after a couple of months in college, I had had enough, and I just decided I'm going to stop drinking. And I knew some people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that that fellowship was out there, and I had a sense in, you know, I had a neighbor that I grew up with who was a sober AA member. She'd been sober for many, many years, and I was friends with her kids. And the whole thing kind of creeped me out. I mean, what I remember about her was she and her husband were divorced, which was like, you may as well have been from Mars for me, for the way that I grew up. Her parents were divorced, and I didn't have any divorced people around me at all. And they were divorced, and all I knew is all these kind of strange-looking men came over to her house around 8:30 or 9 and smoked a lot in the kitchen and drank a lot of coffee, and then they all left. And I thought, that's AA, and I don't know what that is, but that creeps me out. And that is what AA is, actually, in a way. And that's the AA that I came into, which I love now. But I just thought, it's kind of strange. And so I wound up going to meetings with someone that I was like wildly attracted to, who had a court slip. And he was in big trouble. And I don't know that I ignored that or I was attracted to it. I don't know what it was, but the fact that he was in trouble and the law was involved and he had to go to these meetings, and he's like, can we go out? I'm like, yeah, we can go out. And he said, you got to drive me, you know, if we're going to go out. And we got to go to these meetings first because I got to get this court slip signed. And that's kind of how I went into Alcoholics Anonymous, was going on these dates with this guy who wanted me to drive and carry him to meetings. And so I'm just going along doing it, not really thinking a thing of it. So when I got into AA, I was like, I really loved what was going on in here. I loved all the people I saw. I loved, where I came into AA, there was like steps up on the wall, literature like this, you know, AA symbols everywhere, and they drank coffee out of real coffee cups and saucers, and everyone was smoking, and everyone was having a really good time. And I thought, my God, it's so great. This place is here for you people. And it never, ever crossed my mind that I needed to be here. And to me, I've come to understand a gigantic difference between I've got a problem with alcohol and I'm powerless over alcohol, or I'm an alcoholic. The truth was that I was running around powerless over alcohol with no clue on the planet that that was the state of me. But when I came into the program with my date, And I looked up at the steps. I thought a whole lot of things that didn't apply to me, and I'll try to tell you quickly what they are. But I definitely didn't think I was powerless. I'd gone any number of months, probably a year, without having any alcohol on my own. And so I'm looking up there at the thing going, well, clearly I'm not powerless over alcohol because I've gone a year without drinking on my own. And this is the place for the powerless people, and this is why they need to go to all these meetings and do all this stuff. And then, you know, I grew up in a religious family, and, well, let me just pause and say, if you're new in this fellowship, this little mini story might be hard to follow if you're not familiar with the steps, but I'll try to go into it a little bit. But there are a whole bunch of steps that have to do with the God stuff, and so I grew up in this Christian family, and I'm looking at the God stuff thinking, well, I'll just skip all those God steps because I already got the God thing down. And I really did have the God thing down, actually, if you ask me. I still, to this day, think I have the God thing down. I just missed how the God thing down had anything to do with the alcoholism or how the alcoholism recovery had anything to do with the God thing. But I thought I had a handle on the God thing. I went to Sunday school when I was a kid. When I was in high school, I was in Young Life. When I was in college, I was in a Christian fellowship. Nobody was doing that. You got to be, I think. I mean, my experience of it as a young church-going person was you got to be some kind of goober or something to be involved in that level in college when everyone else is trying to go out and party, party, party. I'm running around to these Christian fellowships where everyone's, you know, playing games and playing the guitar and doing all this. And then when I'm out of there, I'm running back to the dorm and drinking like a fish. Anyway, I'm looking at those steps. And so I skipped 2 and 3 because they were God steps. And I skipped 4 and 5, which are the inventory steps, because I didn't believe there was anything wrong with me except I drank a little bit too much. So I couldn't understand why anybody would, you know, like me, would feel the need to take an inventory. I came from a nice family. I was a nice person. I never called anybody names. I never did anything wrong. That's just the whole thing I told myself. So I skipped 4 and 5, and then I skipped 6 and 7, because those are about the willingness to let go of those character defects that I didn't have, so I skipped those. And then I skipped 8 and 9, which are the amends steps, because I really believed that I hadn't hurt anybody, and I wasn't even really sure I'd hurt myself. I thought I had just, like, held on to a hot pot a little too long. You know, when you put it back down and you shake your hand, you're like, damn. I thought that was the end of the destruction right there, that I was really smart and I had really caught it early. And I think, in a way, I had caught it early, but in a huge way, I had not. And the huge way was what, like, as plain as the nose on my face, but I wasn't looking, and I certainly wasn't looking in a mirror. So I skipped 8 and 9, the amends steps, and then if you're going to skip 4, which is an inventory step, you may as well skip 10, because it's another inventory step. And then I skipped 11, because that's the God step, too. And I pretty much skipped everything about 12, except for I thought maybe if I went to enough of these meetings, I might be able to do a halfway decent job of carrying the message. And that's when all the keep coming backs started rolling in, you know. That's when everyone was like, hi, keep coming back and patting me on the back. And, you know, you're really sweet and you're really fun. Keep coming back, you know. Just keep coming back, dear. And so I did. I did keep coming back. But the thing is, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, putting the plug in the jug is just not enough. You know, I really think that we have, or I'll speak for myself, I have a disease that has an emotional, physical, and spiritual component. And just knocking out the alcohol is one third of it. And it leaves the other two thirds completely untreated, which is the majority. And the majority is going to eventually, you know, take over or get the best of me. If I don't do anything about the emotional and spiritual stuff, then it's not going to be long before I'm back in the saddle with the physical stuff. Now, I had no clue about that coming in. I didn't get that at all. And I didn't get that until I drank again after I decided I would I was fine, which is part of the emotional and spiritual stuff that was untreated. It was that untreated emotional and spiritual stuff that would say things like, I'm not powerless, I'm fine, there's nothing wrong with me except for the fact that I drank too much, and I don't need this fellowship or these people, but I'm really glad it's here for you. So that was my take on AA. And, you know, I don't like to get into everything that I did, because it's kind of like the details of my fourth step material. But in my first 3 years of sobriety, when I wasn't putting the steps into my life, I didn't change very much at all. And I had a really hard time taking what was happening in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the room and into my life. It's like, you know how if you study crowd behavior, people will do in a crowd a bunch of stuff they're not willing to do on their own. That's the, kind of the downside. Like when you look at, they're willing to do negative stuff. I had the experience of, I was willing to think about these steps and think about these principles when I was surrounded by people in AA. But I had no notion in the world that the idea was to practice these principles in all my affairs and carry it on out of there and apply that in every area of my life. And the reason I didn't get that as a solution is because I didn't get the problem. You know, it makes sense. It's like if you don't have the problem, then you're not going to apply the solution. And I certainly didn't believe that my alcoholism had infiltrated and negatively impacted every area of my life. Mostly because I wasn't looking. And also because I really believe it's a disease of a denial. I believe a lot of the cliches and slogans that I heard in AA, you know, it's a disease that tells you you don't have one. Denial's a lot like sleep. You never know you've been in it until you wake up. You know, those kinds of things I'm able to see and to believe now. But, you know, I just had stuff going on in my life that wasn't good. It was kind of like really pulling at those two worlds, pulling, tearing apart the me that I thought I was raised to be, the me that I wanted to be. You know, and it could have been anything. I mean, it could have been anything like I'm sitting at the diner. I hate to bring up examples because if people are still doing it, I'm always like, ugh. But if I'm sitting at the diner, you know, and the waitress brings me, doesn't charge me for half my meal by accident or brings me too much money or something like that, I'd be like, hot damn. I'd run out the door with the extra money and, you know, just be like, hey, it's not my fault if she's not on the ball. Nobody's going to notice it. You know, just little things like that. That's just a little thing. But for me and my spiritual program today, it has a huge impact. The impact it has is it puts all kinds of cracks in the foundation of my recovery. It just puts all these teeny tiny little hairline fractures. And then, you know, one day the big old storm's going to come along and the whole structure is going to come collapsing down because of all these little hairline fractures. Now, does that mean that I'm supposed to be like some perfect saint? No. I truly believe what it says in our literature, that it's progress, not perfection. But we don't make a bunch of hair, I don't make a bunch of hairline cracks that I don't try to fix anymore, for starters. If I do manage to put them into my program, I'm like right on top of it. As soon as I realize that I've done it, I'm right on top of it, trying to make it right in whatever way that I can, which is completely different from how I used to be. So it was little things like the waitress and the diner and stuff like that. It was also things like having gigantic affairs because what you don't know won't hurt you. Or cheating on my test because I decided that going out with my friends to such and such a place was more important than studying for my test. And if I could get the answers for the test and get them on the paper, what difference does it make if I studied the material or not? Just completely turned off in there. There was one more example I wanted to mention, but I can't think of it right now. If it comes to me, I'll mention it later. But anyway, that's kind of the idea. The other idea is you can take the rum out of the fruitcake, but you still got the fruitcake. That's the short story. That's what I think of as the short story. And that's kind of how I was running around in AA. Anyway, that wasn't working for me. And there came a time in my life where I figured I'd been sober long enough, I wanted to have some alcohol in my room. I was living in a dorm room about this big with my flaming alcoholic roommate, and I was not drinking. And so I decided that, like my parents, I was going to have some beer in the fridge for the company. And what's funny about that is I was not an executive like my father was. I was not having holiday Christmas parties where all the other little executives were going to come over and have a nice dinner. I had a fridge, a room that was this big and a fridge that was this big. And I wanted to have beer in the fridge for the company because it's what I was used to growing up. And that's just how I thought of it. And so I started justifying why I needed to have alcohol. Now, this is not the position of AA. AA couldn't care less if you have alcohol in your fridge. We don't have any opinions on stuff like that. And plenty sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous can have, like, they can have so much alcohol around them, they can look like the flies on a fly strip, you know, like there's a fly strip and there's booze everywhere, and it doesn't affect them at all, you know. But I'm the kind of alcoholic that I don't want it around me in certain spaces, because if I leave it around me for a long period of time, it chips away at my quality and my sobriety. But anyhow, I decided beer in the fridge for the company, so went out and bought the beer, my favorite kind, myself, in the fridge, you know. And one of my favorite, I got a lot of favorite AA slogans, I say them all the time, which is kind of nauseating, because I'm like a lot of other people who came in and were really turned off by the slogans. And I thought, oh my God, the last thing in the world I would want to turn into is a slogan spitting, handshaking, smiling, happy, joyous, and free alcoholic. That's what I turned into. But that one of the ones I heard early on was, if you hang around the barbershop long enough, sooner or later you're going to get a haircut. And so that was how people told me that I needed to, you know, change people, places, and things. And so I told my roommate if I was talking about drinking or something like that to call my friends in AA. I don't think that's how it works, but that's what I said to her. And she's an alcoholic, and she didn't care anyway, but she's like, okay. And so, you know, she came home from school or whatever, and I had popped open the beer and had all these people over, and I'm having beer for the company. And then, you know, she comes home another time, and I've got more beer and all the people over, and I'm having the beer too. And she's like, FB, I thought you weren't going to be drinking. And I'm like, I'm not drinking. And you don't have to worry about me if I'm drinking when there's a party going on. You got to worry about me if I'm drunk. And so she is like, okay. And she keeps on drinking, and she's not worried. And then she comes home again, and the party's going on again, and I'm drinking again, and this time I'm all drunk. And she's poking me, going, SB, I thought you weren't supposed to be getting drunk. And I'm like, it doesn't matter if I'm drunk and there's a party going on. It just matters if I'm drunk by myself. And she's like, okay. And she wanders off and she keeps on drinking. And I'm like inching this line along, inch by inch by inch. I'm okay as long as I don't blank. I'm okay as long as I don't blank. And I'm erasing it and drawing it over and erasing it and drawing it over. You know, and it's not her responsibility to keep me sober or anything like that, but I made some kind of stupid effort to get her to support me and then didn't do much to support myself. People were telling me to put the steps into my life. People were telling me to go to more meetings. They were saying things like meeting makers make it. They were saying little meetings, a little recovery, a lot of meetings, a lot of recovery. But I had already done those steps that day that I was looking at the wall going, I'm not powerless. I got the God thing. There's nothing wrong with me except I drink a little bit too much. I didn't hurt anybody but myself, if that. And, you know, on and on and on. So, you know, I was off to the races when I started again. And I lost my interest in Alcoholics Anonymous after I started drinking again. Imagine that. I mean, another slogan I like is, there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. And I didn't find that out until way down the line. I was out there drinking again for a year and a half, and for 6 months, I thought everything went what I thought was well. I don't know what actually happened, but I thought, it's cool. It's cool, it's cool. For like 6 months. And after that, it was like, this is not working. I got to do something about this. And I would say that the last thing before I went to bed at night. And I would wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to drink today. And I'd be drinking by noon, or I'd be drinking by 2, or I'd be drinking by 10, or I'd be drinking by 5. And every single day, I was waking up telling myself, this ain't working, and I can't do this anymore. And I've got to cut this out, and I would be drinking by whenever. And then after I was drinking by whenever, I'd go, oh, crap, I was going to stop drinking today. And then I was like, oh, well, I'll stop tomorrow. And I would drink on into the night. And all the things that had never happened to me, all the things that I thought that I would say were the reasons I didn't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous were just kind of dropping into my life or tumbling into my life one by one. So whatever my list of nevers were or not yets, they were starting to manifest, and not every single one. For instance, I never got a DWI. I've never had one yet. Doesn't mean I'll never get one. Just means I haven't had one yet. But I had a whole bunch of things that were not happening that had started happening. And one of them was not being able to turn off the drinking. So, and when I was out there relapsing, I got an experience of powerlessness that I'd never had before and developed an understanding of it that I had never had before. And, you know, I was one of those people who came into AA and heard, it's the first drink that gets you drunk, and I'm so smart, I'm sitting there going, nuh-uh, it's the fifth, like everyone else. I can't, or the sixth, or the eighth. I can't tell you how many people I've heard say that and think that since, but I was sitting there saying and thinking the same thing. And my friend Max said to me, you know, when you get run over by a train, Sarah Beth, it ain't the caboose that kills you. And he said that to me on the heels of my year and a half of drinking, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. I knew exactly what it meant to be hit by the engine that was pulling the train. And, you know, and believe that it was the first drink that got me drunk and not the fifth or the eighth or the tenth. But I couldn't get back in. And the only thing that I've ever experienced in my non-alcoholic life that was anything like it was getting caught in a riptide. I don't know if you've ever gotten caught in a riptide, but I've gotten caught in a very bad riptide very close to shore, where shore was only like 4 feet away. And I could not get my foot up on that sand to save my life. And the sand was there, and the sand was there, and I'm lifting up my foot, and this riptide is dragging me down, and everything that I've ever been told about what I needed to do in a riptide, right out of my brain. I mean, all you got to do is relax and float down with the current, but I couldn't do any of that. And I just tried and tried and tried and tried and tried to get up on that shore, until I nearly beat myself to death. And that's exactly this experience that I had of my powerlessness this time in my relapse. And what happened on the beach was some big dude was standing there, and he was a big dude. That's why he was able to lean over and pull me out of this thing. And I had the experience of being kind of lifted out of my alcoholism on the night of my last drunk, when I got in a big bar fight with a chick in front of a bar in Laurel, Maryland. And that was the last night of my drinking. And the thing I want to say about that night and this story is that I was in there with this friend that I loved, and as soon as we started going like this, we started going like this with our fists, you know, as soon as we were doing the drinking. We started fighting with our words first and then with our fists out in front of the street. And when there wasn't alcohol involved, we didn't do that. And so we were taking this fight out into the street. And I remember standing there thinking, you are not going to beat up on me, period, ever again. And I was like really puffed up about it. I don't know if you know what I mean, but I was like really puffed up. And I'm like, come on, you know, daring this person to hit me. And she had shoved me around a little bit, and the more she shoved me around, the madder I got and the puffier I got. And so she hauls off and hits me as hard as she can, and I go flying across the parking lot. I mean, she knocked me in the next week, and I remember falling down, lying on my back there, you know, completely decked. But before she did that, I shoved her up against the wall with my attitude, like, you know, you are never, ever going to do that to me because I am me. You know, like we talk about, my friend Don H. says, recovery begins when the great I am becomes nothing. I was not the great I am becoming nothing. I was just the great I am. I mean, I had like had her against the wall. The second I let her go, she knocked me. And, it wasn't that I'd never been hit or that I'd never been in a fight or that I'd never been on my back in a parking lot. But this particular time, I hit my head on the back of the gravel and I was looking up at the stars and way up there was total peace. I mean, sky as black as night, twinkling stars everywhere, probably, you know, quite cold and a bit crisp like it is tonight. I just looked up there, and I just thought, damn, those old guys in AA were right. Everything they said has come to pass, you know, in my life. And I was just so, I completely surrendered. I don't know how to describe that moment any differently, but I just had, like, thrown up the white flag. I had just... You know, like it talks about, I can use the big book, that's a good way to describe it. Like it says in chapter 3 and more about alcoholism, we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. I was lying there fully conceded to my innermost self. Didn't matter who else thought what I had told myself, I was done. And I got up and I dusted myself off and I carried myself back to a meeting the next day and I picked up a white chip. And I started to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous instead of the guest of some guy who was coming in on a court slip. And I consider myself an alcoholic from that point on, and I consider myself a member of AA. And I actually, in my heart, joined the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, I'm one of those people that needs this fellowship in order to stay sober. And everything changed for me at that point. I had been quite helpful in AA before because I was raised that way. I was always friendly. I was always helping cleaning up and all that kind of stuff. But this time I was cleaning up because I believed it was what I needed to do to save my life, not because I'm sweet and this is how my mama raised me. It was a completely different thing, a completely different call to service than it was beforehand. So I started coming around to a lot of meetings. I started following around with a lot of people who had more sobriety than I had. I begrudgingly got this woman to sponsor me. There was only one woman in the room I didn't like, and that's the one I wound up getting to sponsor me because my friend Max said, no, she's the one. I'm like, no, she's not the one. Oh, she's the one. Oh, no, she's not the one. And I was all young and hip and slick and everything, and she was old, really old, and I thought not very hip and not very slick. I mean, If you magnified that character, Maxine, on the greeting cards by like 25, she was a lot like that. And I'm like, I can't take that. He's like, oh no, you can take it, and you're going to take it. And so I got her to sponsor me, and she was the best thing that ever happened to me. And she started me through those steps, and, you know, she's like, you know, tell me, she just got me talking about what part, all the stuff, all my understanding of my drinking that I wasn't turning over to my higher power, how I was trying to, like, I mean, with my alcoholism, I was like a paranoid crackhead in an apartment with all the blinds drawn, and God was on the outside, and I was afraid he was going to get in and mess it up. You know, I mean, I felt like it all needed to be separate. And that's a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, a lot of any number of things. But what it mostly was a lot of false pride and big ego, which I heard in AA was an acronym for easing God out, but it was a lot of, no, I'm going to do this myself, which I don't feel that way anymore, pretty much about anything. I let people help me in ways that I cannot imagine today, or could not have imagined at that time, but I'm getting used to it now. But I started to put the steps into my life, and I took my inventory, and I kind of went the other way, where I wasn't willing to look at everything. I probably looked at way too much. Like, I've seen people write really short inventories, for the most part, where they write their resentments and their fears, and I wrote about the seven deadly sins, every example that I could ever think of where I'd ever done any single one of them, any time, anything that was in my memory banks, and I wrote all my resentments and fears and all the things that I believe I'd done wrong and to whom. And I started with things like when I was 5 years old, I'm making up the age, let's say, and my mother said, make a peanut butter jelly and sandwich, cut it in half and give your brother half. I took the bigger half and I put that down. Every single instance that I could remember where I put myself first, operated out of my self-centered nature, because that was the truth of me, really. The truth of me was, left to my own devices without anybody watching, I would cut the sandwich in half and give my brother, who I loved, the smaller half. And Alcoholics Anonymous has changed that in me today. It's not that that person isn't there. It's that that person isn't driving the bus. The person that drinks at my problems, the person who thinks I'm not powerless over alcohol, the person who thinks it's okay to have a beer, is not driving the bus today. I was thinking about this story, and I mentioned it the other day when I was in a meeting. Somebody was talking about the importance of staying away from the first drink and letting other people help you, and why Alcoholics Anonymous works. It was kind of one of those AA meetings where there were about 10 topics going on. And I thought about the line that Father Martin says, where first the man takes the drink, then the drink takes the drink, then the drink takes the man. That's another thing that sums it up for me so beautifully. And I stay very focused on the idea of then the drink takes the drink, so that I can realize that once I put that first one in me, it's not just me making the decisions anymore. It's me with the alcohol in my body. But when I was in college, I was living in a triple when I was a freshman. And one of my roommates was terribly modest. And she had her dresser, like, over in the corner of the room, way far from the door. And she was over there dressing, and she was in her skimpy little T-shirt and her underwear, and it was us, her, and two other girls, myself, I was one of them, in there. And somebody rapped on the door, and so my bed was close to the door, so I went over and opened the door, and in walks this college guy. And she's over there in her underwear, and she looks at me like, Jesus Christ! You know, and she's all mortified because I've let this college boy in the room, and I'm all mortified because I let the college boy in the room. And so we're all standing there like deer in the headlights for a second, and the guy, who's really quick, quick-witted and really funny, looks over and realizes what's going on. And instead of stepping back out of the room, he pulls his shorts down to his ankles. And he's standing there in his underwear, his little tighty-whities, and his gym shorts around his ankles. And then he kept on talking. And he kept on saying what he came in there to say. And that's a true story. And that was one of the wildest experiences I've ever had, and also the closest I've ever come to understanding what has happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I'm coming in, I'm terribly embarrassed, I'm full of shame, I'm mortified, and I'm like, I don't want to show my backside. I don't want to show my backside. But I have to, because I have come to believe that if I don't say how it is and I don't tell the truth, you know, we talk about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, and we talk about unity and service and recovery. That's how those are the things that I use to evaluate my program. I'm on my way out of here, and I don't want to be out of here. I've already decided that I want to be in here, and I don't want to be on my way out. And so when I come in and I pull down my pants, somebody doesn't say to me, you know, you need to do this and you need to do that. To me, that isn't how the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was carried. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, was carried the way Bill and Dr. Bob carried it to the third drunk, which is, we're not trying to cheat you out of your drinking or anything. And God knows, I felt like I was getting cheated out of my drinking, getting sober at 23. I was like, I'll come back in when I'm 63. But that's how they carried the message, and they just said, we lay this spiritual toolkit out, and if you take it, want it, and if you don't want it, we'll move on to someone else. So I come into AA, and I pull my pants down and share my problem. And when someone says, when someone's given me feedback, they don't tell me anything. They just pull their pants down, too. And there we are standing there, because we have the same problem. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it's a kooky analogy, but it works for me. Because there's nothing, I've never seen anything suck fear and anxiety and shame and mortification out of a room as quickly as that boy pulling down his pants to make her feel comfortable. And that's what happened to me in AA. I came in here with all my problems about how different I am, how special I am, and all I got was a bunch of me too, and a bunch of nodding heads, and a bunch of people cracking up, and a bunch of people telling stories that in a lot of places were even worse than my own. And instead of comparing myself out, I got my face in the book and I read, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experiences can benefit others. And that means that people who were in the gutter and who were the gutter drunks can help me. And that means the people who are in Skid Row can help me. And that means that I can help the people also who are in Skid Row. I heard also in here that Skid Row is a place between the ears. And that's where my alcoholism brought me. And it'll bring me there again fast if I don't put the steps and the traditions and the unity and service into my life. So that's it. Thanks.